to vet, today would be a great day to say thank you to him or her. Just ahead of the morning show with Greg Berg, quick check on the forecast from the National Weather Service. Mostly sunny, breezy, and mild today, a high of 51. Right now, sunny, 40 degrees Racine, 39 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. That playful music is by Percy Grainger. It's his Shepherd's Hay, and it is one of just a number of beautiful and joyous pieces that are going to be part of Saturday afternoon's concert by the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra. And I am very, very pleased on today's morning show to be speaking with three people who will be very much involved in Saturday afternoon's concert. First of all, on the podium, Maestro Bob Hasty, and in the horn section, I believe, and president of the board is Peter Rodriguez. And bringing her Lincoln Chamber Singers from Carthage College is Dr. Maggie Burke, who is director of choral activities at Carthage. And the Lincoln Chamber Singers will be playing a very central role in Saturday afternoon's concert at Reuther High School Auditorium, a concert very generously underwritten by Snap-on. And so I'm excited for this opportunity for us to talk about what is going to be offered up on Saturday afternoon's concert. We welcome all three of you to the morning show.
Good morning, Greg.
Good to have you all here. Peter Rodriguez, just tell us briefly how this concert fits into the overall season of the Kenosha Symphony. Where have we already been? Where are we going after Saturday afternoon's concert?
Sure. This is the second concert in our season this year. Our last one was back in October. But, I mean, to be honest, this is our most attended concert every year. We typically have 400-plus people in attendance, and we're extremely fortunate to have this collaboration that we're doing with the Lincoln Chamber Singers as well as the Kenosha Academy of Performing Arts. It's going to be a fantastic concert. And as you mentioned, I can't underscore how important it is that we've had this incredible support from Snap-on Incorporated. They've been supporting this concert for quite a number of years, and we're especially appreciative.
They are certainly exemplary corporate citizens, community citizens in every sense of the word. So it's great to be able to acknowledge that. Maestro Bob Hasty, tell us a little bit about what goes into the putting together of a concert like this. I mean, it's certainly a different experience from a more standard concert where you start with an overture and then you do a concerto, then you have an intermission, and then you play a symphony. I mean, that's not always the way it works, but quite often that's kind of the standard template. And this, of course, breaks that mold quite decisively. Tell us the kind of things that you think about as artistic director in terms of putting this program together and who should be involved and who should be invited as special guests?
I would say that in terms of the amount of time that I spend on programming any particular concert, the amount I spend much more time on holiday concerts and Pops concerts. Those are the ones that are kind of in a complete other lane of a symphony orchestra. And so for me, it's I sit down with music that is outside of the normal classical repertoire, and I have to kind of put a lot more pieces together. Also with these concerts, with a traditional symphonic concert, you might have three pieces, as you mentioned. And in this case, we have about a dozen or more. They're just all shorter. So so that is part of the challenge of coming up with a program that will be appealing to the audience while also showcasing the professionalism and the professional talents of your local professional symphony orchestra. So you want to make sure that the orchestra is showcased with its virtuosity, but also having appealing works for the audience, because the audience now, this has become a huge tradition in Kenosha. This isn't just a symphonic event. This is a community event. We like to bring in guests such as the Kenosha Academy of Performing Arts and Lincoln Chamber Singers. And we've brought in other guests in the past, as well as a very important baritone named Gregory Berg once, who sang one of our Fantasias with us. So the other challenge is that there are certain favorites that the audience expects when they come to a holiday concert. They want to make sure that they hear this Christmas carol, that one, and this one. And so how do you keep the program fresh and new every year? And how do you still make it attractive to the traditional annual festive expectation of the holidays? So, yes, I would say every orchestra that does this, we do recycle a lot. So there's a lot of things that the orchestra knows very, very well. For instance, with Sleigh Ride, which we always finish with Sleigh Ride, there have been years that I have just had not enough time to rehearse it. And so the only time you've heard it is in the concert, because everybody just knows it so well. But I do like to bring in something new to, so the audience that comes to hear Jingle Bells and Sleigh Ride will then get to hear some important music that we don't normally, wouldn't normally get to perform in other contexts. So for instance, we have two composers on this program that are heavily influenced by film music, and Serge Prokofiev is one of them. The Troika that we are performing, which is from a film that he wrote for, and it's a scene from a Sleigh Ride in the movie. And his music had a huge influence on film music later. And so then you have another composer like Eric Korngold, who wrote this music for what was called The Snowman when he was 11 years old. And this music is from when he was 11, but his teacher, Zemlinsky, orchestrated it. Famously, Korngold went to Hollywood, wrote the music for Robin Hood, Errol Flynn's Robin Hood, and that his address changed permanently to Hollywood. So we have some very important composers. So the people who are classical music fans will be able to come and hear some really beautiful music that has been kind of tied. Yes, Snowman, the story of the snowman was around the time of Father Christmas. So yes, that's Christmassy. Who's to say if the movie Lieutenant Kijé was Christmassy at all? But somehow a lot of these, and Shepherd's Hay, you know, it's about shepherds. So, hey, maybe it could be Christmassy. So we're going to be throwing some things, holiday adjacent music, as well as specific holiday music. So we have these beautiful moments of tradition, but hopefully something new. Because this concert has become a community event, I've always invited a choir to come and perform at this and on this program, one of the area choirs. And last year, when Dr. Burke was appointed director of choral activities, I asked if she would like to be invited to bring her singers to perform on this. I was very grateful about that. Back in 2019, I wanted to seek in the community who is doing teaching dance, who is doing a ballet. And so I was directed to the Kenosha Academy of Performing Arts. And we were doing the Suite from the Nutcracker that year. And they said they would, their kids were already doing it to a recording, their students. And why not, let's just do it with a live symphony orchestra. And it became such a huge highlight. After COVID, we were able to bring them back last year. And we thought, you know what, let's make this an every year thing, but it doesn't have to be Nutcracker. So you're going to see them dancing on the Skater's Waltz. You're going to see them dancing on Lieutenant Kijé, the Troika. So they're and I have to mention the name of the choreographer, Annette Lonizak, who, when you see the choreography, it is brand new choreography. She has choreographed and taught the students of the academy since the fall, and they will be performing with the orchestra this weekend. So it's a big community event. We expect the audience to sing along as well. We have a point where we want them to sing, and it's just a great way to kick off the holiday season. Mm-hmm.
For those of you just joining us, we are talking about Saturday afternoon's concert by the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra, always an enormously popular and well-attended event designed for the whole community and designed for the whole family. And with us on the morning show today, Maestro Bob Hasty, who will be the conductor, and he is artistic director of the Kenosha Symphony, Peter Rodriguez, who is president of the board and a member of the horn section. And Peter, I assume you're going to be playing on Saturday afternoon?
I am going to be playing.
All right, good. And also with us is a faculty colleague of mine from Carthage College, Dr. Maggie Burke. And she will be bringing the Lincoln Chamber Singers to be part of this program. And Dr. Burke, one of the interesting things about what's going to happen Saturday afternoon is that your chamber singers will be doing a few things on their own. And also, I understand, doing at least one thing that the full Carthage Choir sang on the recent Christmas festival. Before we get to the other thing, which involves the orchestra, tell us about the repertoire that they'll be doing on their own, and in particular, this experience of taking a work for the full choir and serving it up with just the 12 voices of the chamber singers.
Yeah, so the Lincoln Chamber Singers will be singing four pieces on our own on Saturday in the lovely Ruther Auditorium. We'll open with a piece from the English Renaissance, the late English Renaissance, by Peter Phillips called Obeatum et Sacrosanctum Diem, which is all about describing the wonders of and rejoicing of the day of Christmas. And that piece, you'll hear these very short sections that change rapidly, which is kind of a hallmark of the late Renaissance, early Baroque style. Then we'll sing a piece that I composed for actually a conference in Dallas last summer, which is a setting of Psalm 139, Darkness is No Darkness, which is the aforementioned piece from the Carthage Christmas Festival. When I'm going from 40 singers to 12, you know, obviously there's some things that have to move and shake and change. But I think the cool thing is that it allows these 12 singers to experience something on a more intimate level in terms of how to listen to one another, how to feel a phrase, how to shade and push and pull with things. And I'm really, really excited to share that piece with the community. And immediately following that piece, we're going to sing a piece by Mitchell Southall called In Silent Night. Mitchell Southall was a Black composer and a conductor who died in the early 20th century. This piece, he calls it a vignette in pastel, which I think is a perfect description of what it is. You have some influence of some vocal jazz. You have kind of a traditional choral sound. It's a really interesting mix of genres. But what I think I love most about it is that it is extremely intimate and it is very, very heartfelt and sincere. And I think my 12 singers pulled off really, really well. Mm-hmm. And finally, we will end our set with Francis Poulenc's Odie Christus Natus Est from his four Christmas motets, which is a very joyful, very quirky, very eccentric, pure Poulenc style take on the traditional text. Today Christ is born, Odie Christus Natus Est.
Wonderful. Then my understanding is that you will be collaborating with the orchestra in an arrangement of a really beloved Christmas piece called Gesù Bambino by Pietro Jan. Am I correct? Am I
correct? Voice students, yeah, absolutely.
Giving me good information?
It was a piece that was Pietro Jan was he was born in Piedmont in Italy, and he eventually emigrated to the U.S. He composed this carol in 1917, which is a couple of years after he came to the U.S. And you'll hear there's lovely flowing melodies, kind of a Sicilian rhythm. It's 12-8, 1-2-3, yum bum bum bum. But then in the refrain, you're going to hear this very familiar setting of "Oh come let us adore him" from the tune "Oh come all you faithful." So it's a really lovely mix of two different melodies that is going to be very lush with the orchestra, and I'm very excited to experience it.
Great. Did you choose that, or did Maestro Hasty, or did you kind of come to choose it together?
I'd say it was a collaborative process.
Yeah, we had to kind of look and see, well, what music do we have, and then that we can collaborate on together, and so I provide Dr. Burke a list of the pieces that are already in our library. And perhaps Carthage might have some in their library as well that we can collaborate on. This is one that we had not done yet before. And and of course, because I don't live near the library, we found out later that it was only a single melody in the choir. But Dr. Burke and I found online, and I think what you're going to hear in terms of the harmony is Dr. Burke's own arranging abilities to hear a four-part harmony on this beautiful Italian Christmas carol that we have not performed since I've been a part of the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra, but we're going to do it for the first time, and it'll be a little bit of the original, but with a little hint of Dr. Burke's harmonizations.
I have a feeling.
And a little bit of mine, a little bit of somebody from CPDL. You know, yes. We kind of make it all work together.
Right. So. Well, that should be beautiful. That's actually one of my very, very favorite Christmas pieces. And I know it will be actually quite familiar to a lot of people, although the couple of guys that told me about the concert, this was brand new to them. They had no idea of Pietro Jan's Gesù Bambino. So new to some of these students, but I think very familiar to a whole lot of people in the audience. I'm sure it will all be lovely. Maestro Hasty, how tricky is it to put together a concert? I mean, once you've decided, I mean, you've already talked about the kind of the complicated array of things you have to think about in order to assemble the program. Once it comes to rehearsing it, aside from the things like sleigh ride that they practically play in their sleep if need be, how difficult is it to actually take care of all of these different pieces? I should think that it's more than all the sum of the parts. That is, even if it's the sheer amount of music is maybe roughly the same of a standard program, but the fact that it's so many different styles, so many different composers, I should think that really complicates your task and their task of mastering all of this for the program.
It's a lot of moving parts, a lot of logistics. I think the fact that I have had some high school and middle school background in my teaching career will say that I'm used to a lot of moving parts. So Annette Lonizak and Maggie Burke received my rehearsal schedule about a week ago, and it's really tailor-made to, we've got parents who need to drop off their kids and then pick them up at a certain time. So we're going to start with just those pieces, and then we're going to have an opportunity to rehearse with the choir, and then we need to have the choir have an opportunity to rehearse by themselves without the orchestra, and then the orchestra has a handful of pieces they do without anybody else. So when you see the performance, it'll be the first time we will have gone through it from beginning to end. But that's what it is. It's a showcase. It's not a concert per se. It's a showcase. So we could say, and over here we have this piece, and over here we have this piece, and over here we have this group of guests. So the fact that it's a more of a community event for Kenosha, an afternoon with lots of families, it doesn't have that kind of button-down attitude of a symphonic orchestra concert, but it's more of a celebration. So even though in our rehearsal we will be rehearsing out of order in order to accommodate, like I said, parents picking up their kids and college students arriving at a certain time and things like that, it always goes well.
Peter Rodriguez, as a member of the orchestra, what's it like from your vantage point to play a concert like this versus the more standard thing with three, possibly four works on the program? What's it like for the players? What kind of a challenge does this represent? Is it fun? Is it frustrating? Is it kind of a crazy mix?
I would say, yeah, it's kind of a crazy mix. It is a lot of music to have to rehearse ahead of time on our own. We do only have one rehearsal before the actual concert, so we're all expected to be super prepared so that we can provide the best experience for our listeners. But yeah, it's a fun challenge, I feel, because you kind of, you know, when you have multiple rehearsals, not to say that you can slack off a little bit, but perhaps there's a little bit less pressure when you know you have three, because that's usually what we have. But to get it all done in one is a special effort.
So the concert is coming up this Saturday afternoon at 3 o'clock in the beautiful auditorium at Reuther High School. And Dr. Burke, you've already collaborated with the Kenosha Symphony before, so you actually know that space and what a lovely space it is, I think.
Absolutely. It's going to be a great afternoon.
Very good. And before we let you go, maybe you can just say a quick word about the singers you're bringing with them and what they are just fresh off of. That is the really exquisite Christmas festival performance that just occurred at Carthage last weekend.
Absolutely. We had our 149th annual Carthage Christmas Festival, which was just this past weekend at Carthage. And the Lincoln Chamber Singers were part of four choirs that sang at that event, as well as our Philharmonic Orchestra and our Wind Orchestra. It was a great program. It was called Rejoice, O World, and lots of really colorful and exciting music that really brought the community together in a beautiful way. We had about 3,000 people who attended, which is really, really exciting, and it was a great way to kick off the Christmas season.
And of course, for you, it was especially challenging in that you were waving the baton in front of all four of the ensembles. This has been quite a year for you.
Yeah, absolutely. It has certainly been a change for me. You know, last year I conducted two choirs at Carthage, and now I have four. So I definitely worked hard for that. So hopefully burned a few calories at least over the weekend. but all the students did a really, really, really phenomenal job, and I was really proud to be in front of all of them. So
very good. Well, I know people will be very excited to be able to hear the Lincoln Chamber Singers under your direction as part of this concert Saturday afternoon. Peter Rodriguez, do you have a favorite piece that the orchestra is playing that you're especially looking forward to?
Yeah, actually, there are a couple that I know. You mentioned Shepherd's Hay and played a little clip of that, but that's a fun piece to play in the horn section. We've got a little bit of noodling to do. And what's the other one I like? There's a piece that's a newer piece, Fantasia, on a theme of Three Kings, right, Bob? I think that's the name, but it's by Brian Balmagis. It's written within the past year, and that's also a fun one to play.
Yeah, it's nice to be able to do something new that the audience may not have heard. Brian Balmagis is a very important composer, living composer today, and And this Fantasia on We Three Kings is something that is very symphonic, that also includes What Child Is This? So one of those pieces that's going to be audience friendly because they can recognize something familiar in it, but it's also completely brand new. One of our most important composers living today is Brian Belmontis.
And Greg, I don't think I'm biased, but I probably am. At the end of the piece, the horns get to lift their bells. It's written in the part, bells up. So it's nice to hear that played prominently in that piece.
A moment of glory for the horns. That sounds terrific. The whole program sounds lovely. And again, it's going to be what sounds like a really special mix of some of these relatively new and maybe unfamiliar pieces. And then you have things like Sleigh Ride and the Christmas Festival of Leroy Anderson, among other seasoned favorites that people I know will look forward to enjoying and recognizing.
And Greg, before we drop, just a couple of details. Tickets are available online at KenoshaSymphony.org. They are $30. Children and students are free. You can also buy tickets at the door. But yeah, we're looking forward to seeing everyone. I also have it on good authority that Santa may be paying us a visit on Saturday. And we will also have candy that has been generously donated to us by Haribo, which is also in Kenosha.
Very good. Well, I know Santa has a busy schedule, but I also know he has very warm feelings for the Kenosha Symphony, so I have no doubt he will come through one way or another. Well, very good. This has been such a fun time finding out about all that's going to be offered up on Saturday afternoon's concert again, 3 o'clock in the Ralph Houghton Auditorium at Reuther High School, a beautiful space for making music, a concert that will include dancers from the Kenosha Academy of Arts and also the Lincoln Chamber Singers from Carthage College. And Peter Rodriguez and Dr. Maggie Burke and Dr. Robert Hasty, thank you so much for being my morning show guests today here on WGTD. It was wonderful to talk with you. Best wishes on Saturday's concert.
Thank you, Greg.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you, Greg.
The final measures to Leroy Anderson's magnificent Christmas Festival, which is on the program for the Kenosha Symphony's Saturday afternoon concert. You're listening to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two of today's program comes from the Morning Show archives. We're going to be talking about manners today on the Morning Show, and specifically how parents can go about instilling a higher standard of manners with their children. And we go to the well-respected name of Post for this discussion, specifically to Cindy Post Senning, who is co-director of the Emily Post Institute. And she is the co-author, along with Peggy Post, of a book called Emily posts The Gift of Good Manners, A Parent's Guide to Raising Respectful, Kind, Considerate Children, published by Harper Resource. And this is a wonderful book, which gives us all kinds of things to think about in terms of the importance of manners and the means by which we might teach the very best in manners to our children. And I'm really glad that I can speak with Cindy Poe-Senning for the next few minutes about this book and the experience of writing it. Cindy Poe-Senning, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you. Good morning.
Before we get to the book itself, I think it would really be fun for our listeners and for me to have a little better sense of the Post name and more specifically, the name of Emily Post, of who she was and what she ended up managing to create.
Well, sure. I love talking about Emily. Emily was my great-grandmother, and back in 1922, she had been writing romance novels and had some association with people in the publishing world who felt at that time that there was a great need for a practical, usable book on etiquette. People were moving into the cities. It was the industrial age was coming, and people were moving away from their rural agrarian homes, where they all knew what to do. In your village at home, if somebody was getting married, everybody knew what the routine was and what the standard was. But if you had just moved to Chicago or New York or Los Angeles and you were invited to dinner somewhere or to a wedding, you didn't know. And so people had a great need for defining the standard and what the standard was. And Emily was an extremely gracious woman who had grown up in New York City and did know, was familiar with the standards, and also had an innate sense of the way we build relationships, and she even articulated this, was by treating each other with respect and consideration, and that manners were tools that we could use to articulate those fundamental principles in our relationships. So she, after being literally harassed by her publishers, said, oh, okay, I'll write the book. It'll be short, and that'll be it. And she wrote this 600-page book that was published in 1922 and was an instant success, immediately went to the top of the bestseller list, and that framed the rest of her life. She was 50 years old at that time and lived till 1960, and all of her work was dedicated to promoting etiquette in this country at that time.
Wonderful. You have collaborated with Peggy Post, and I can't remember what the connection is between the two of you.
Right. Peggy is my sister-in-law. I have three brothers, and Peggy's married to one of my brothers and has been working at the Emily Post Institute, the organization my great-grandmother founded, as our spokesperson, and has rewritten the large etiquette book several times. Peggy got so many questions and concerns from people out there about writing a book to guide parents that she had decided to do that. In the meantime, my background was in both health and education. I've done a lot of work in both those fields with parents and children and maternal child health. And we decided to collaborate and bring our two bases together and work on this book.
Very good. One last question ahead of the book. Tell us what the Emily Post Institute is. You are its co-director.
Yes, it's an organization that my grandmother started in order to continue her work in promoting etiquette in the United States today, trying to get the message out there that the way we build and strengthen our relationships is through the use of etiquette, a combination of manners and those three principles of respect and consideration and honesty.
Very good. We're speaking with Cindy Poe-Senning, co-author of a book which we will now start talking about.
Sure.
Emily Post's The Gift of Good Manners, A Parent's Guide to Raising Respectful, Kind, Considerate Children. You know, it's interesting as I was thinking about this. A lot of times when we think about etiquette and manners among adults, we sort of jump to the erroneous conclusion that it's mostly about which fork to use and that kind of thing. And when, of course, at its heart, it's about things that matter a whole lot more than that. It's really about the way we treat each other.
Right.
Somehow, when I think about teaching manners and etiquette to children, I don't find myself jumping to that erroneous conclusion. Somehow, you just naturally have this sense that that's what manners mean in terms of young people, is how we treat each other. And yet, it's not an easy match, not an easy thing to accomplish in this day and age.
Right. Well, and what we try and do is we see, and it's not easy anyway, because people are dealing with kids at different ages, which is why we've approached this book developmentally. What are the things you can do as your kids move through different developmental stages in their lives? And we have two threads of advice for teaching this. So even as manners change and we get new, you know, I think of manners as the tools or the social skills that we can use in building relationships. But as kids move through their developmental stages, what are the things that we can do? And I suggest two things to parents. First off, I suggest that they know what to expect. So know your children and gain some understanding about what they can do at the different developmental stages in their life. And then expect it. So that's key one. Know what to expect and then expect it. And the second thing is what we call the golden rule of parenting. Always behave the way you want your children to behave. That's really where kids will learn, because through your behavior, you establish a climate or a culture in your own household that is one of those three, based on those three principles.
Something, too, which I think is great, is that this book does not limit itself to teaching your children good manners. But you also have lots of thoughts along the way about parents being themselves very polite, not just for the sake of modeling for their children, but just because they should be and need to be polite in their interactions with, for instance, other parents, with teachers, with doctors, and that kind of thing. What a wonderful idea, because the one is certain to help the other.
Right, and that is how kids learn that. If parents treat teachers with respect and consideration, kids learn that teachers are people to be treated with respect and consideration. If parents try and teach kids a message at home of treating other people respectfully or with consideration, and then go in and are disrespectful, you know, in a setting that's very important to the kids, they get a very mixed message that it becomes hard for them to sort through, and then their behavior changes accordingly, and parents will get mad at them for not being respectful of their teachers and forget how they were, you know, a week ago when they went in angry because the teacher had done something.
I was intrigued at one point in the book when you called etiquette and manners two things, and they both begin with the letter G. You called etiquette as a gift that
right.
we can give to someone, and you also called it glue. And, you know, the one term is a whole lot prettier than the other,
right.
but in both of these respects, it gives us a different sense of why it's worth talking about this and
right.
writing books about this.
Right. I love that. I never thought of them as the two G's. I'll keep that in mind. But yes, well, certainly it's a gift. We talk about it. It's a gift that's free and available to everybody to give to their children. And with manners, kids develop confidence. And it improves their self-esteem because they do better in some of their relationships and some of their interactions, so they get a better self-esteem. And they'll enjoy situations more. If we think about ourselves, if we go to a wedding in a strange culture, if somebody's told us what to expect ahead of time, we'll enjoy the wedding more because we won't worry about doing something wrong. So what we consider that just a tremendous gift, if you think about it, giving your kids confidence, you know, self-esteem, and the ability to enjoy things more and get more out of the various things they're going to do in their lives. Those are terrific gifts. We call it the glue because it really is how we hold relationships together. When we stop treating each other, using manners in the way we treat and work with each other, and stop being respectful, relationships fall apart. People begin to focus on the bad behavior or the behavior that's been hurtful in some way, and they don't focus on what the relationship's about. So in something as simple as if you've paid to have a lesson of some kind and the person who you've paid to have that lesson comes 15 minutes late, you get so worried about not getting your full hour, you know, that lateness really affects the relationship.
Well, and it hurts what manages to be accomplished because it creates this distraction in the middle of it
right.
all.
Right, Exactly. So then the focus shifts to the behavior that's creating the problem, and the whole thing falls apart. So, but if had you been on time, which would be the good manners, then the relationship hangs in there together.
No.
So it works out. It's the glue. When it's missing, relationships fall apart, and when it's there, it helps hold relationships together.
At some point in the book, I can't find it right now, you list a number of the benefits of living the mannerly life, if we want to call it that, and I'm pretty sure that right at the top of that list was self-confidence.
Yes.
That one, and that goes for children as well as adults, that one can move through life.
Yes.
with a greater sense of self-confidence, and that's, of course, huge when it comes to whatever it is that we want to accomplish, or especially when life throws some challenges at us.
Exactly, exactly. And if we know that the way we're presenting ourselves and putting ourselves out there and involving ourselves in relationships is a way that's going to strengthen and build that relationship, we're just going to be more confident in whatever the activity is that we're engaging in.
It's interesting how at certain points in the book, you will break down the larger scheme of manners and etiquette into certain things that we wouldn't necessarily think of. I mean, we obviously know that this has something to do with table manners and something to do with writing thank you notes and that kind of thing.
Right.
But that it also includes something like our values and our ethics. Explain to us a little more about that connection, because I think that's a little less obvious to us.
Well, if we think about it in terms of our ethics, let's think about it in terms of honesty, that third principle, and the way we approach things with honesty, rather, and try and think about the way that can play into our interactions. So when I'm talking with children, say a 10-year-old, you know, and I'm talking with them about going to their grandmother's for dinner, and they don't care for the spinach, you know. They just don't like it, and so they're putting it aside on the plate. And the grandmother has worked all afternoon making this delicious dinner for them and says, "What's the matter? Don't you like the spinach, you know?" Well, you can go with the white lie and say, "Oh, well, I'm full, Grandma," or whatever, you know. Or you can instead, and we teach kids to say this, how can you be honest and turn it into a positive experience. You can say, "You know, Grandma, I've never really cared for spinach a whole lot, but this chicken is so delicious. Thank you for making it." Well, now they've been honest about the spinach, but they've established, you know, the grandmother's now thinking, "Oh, good, she loves the chicken." It immediately deflects the negativism. So there are ways that we can be honest about things, and we encourage people not to go with the white lie thinking that that's the nicer thing to do. It almost always gets you into more hot water. And we talk about working with your kids on what we call benevolent honesty and how you can do that. How do you bypass that question about, you know, how does this taste or how does this look, by framing it in a positive sense. Now, that's something that I think in the way we approach this in the book, as we say, as a family, you have to make some decisions about these things. So as parents, if that's what you're going to commit to, if honesty and being able to build trust in relationships, which naturally we're encouraging people to do, is important to you as a family, then you have to make a commitment to it. And as a parent, you have to agree that you're not going to go to that calling in sick on that beautiful day because you really wanted to go skiing or whatever it is, you know, or not modeling kind of those little dishonesties that may not get you in huge trouble but change set a different tone in your family. Mm.
You know, I better understand now something very early in the book. I was talking about it before, all the benefits of living in a mannerly sort of way, that self-confidence is one of them. But I found the list, and as I looked down it, I start to realize in just what you were explaining now how living this way would develop these kind of things, that we develop more of a consideration for others, more respect for others.
Right.
We develop more common sense. I mean, that's a big part of what you were just describing.
Right.
Tact, of course, and also flexibility.
Yes.
The fact that life throws us things, and it is not a ironclad set of rules
No.
that help us live this life, but something that can move and bend according to the circumstances in which we find ourselves.
That's correct. And if you base them, if you, what we make ironclad is that we're going to live by those three principles. The manners are a little bit more flexible. We can change. We refer to them as guidelines now. We no longer think of them as rules. They are standards, and they do change. The difference between manners and the principles are that the manners do change. The original book has that whole chapter on chaperones. It's not there anymore. There was nothing in the original book about cell phones. There's a whole chapter about cell phones now, you know. So the manners change. They change both over time and from culture to culture. That's what we talk about so often in the book, about parents making some kinds of decisions between themselves so there's consistency in the household about what the culture of that household's going to be. It'll be different. You know, we walk into lots of different houses that do things differently. But the underlying principles of respect and consideration and honesty, in Peggy's, in my opinion, are in they're like rules. You know, those don't change. And when my great-grandmother wrote the book in 1922, they were the basis for all the manners, and they are still the basis for all the manners.
Right. You were talking about how this book works chronologically as children develop through various phases, and it's interesting, you call part of it the age of discovery, and another is the socialization years, another are the bumpy years, surprise, they're the early teenage years, and so on. I think at the start of each section you have a little line which says, now's the time to,
yes.
And then there's a little list there of, and of course that, and from that list springs the chapter that follows then, but
right. Those
things which it makes sense to address. And I suppose it really makes sense according to where a child is in his or her development that you tackle the right things, the things that they are capable of truly addressing.
Exactly. That's sort of the know what to expect and then expect it kind of thing. These are the things you can be doing with your child developmentally. You can expect these things from these kids. So I'm just looking at the socialization years, and I have stressed good sportsmanship, 6 through 10 years old. They're just getting into team sports. They're beginning to play with that. This is an important time for them to begin to understand the fundamentals of sportsmanship.
Well, I was looking like age of discovery, which is ages 3 through 5, teach and encourage sharing, that is when you need to really be thinking about that. And I suppose if you don't do that, then we have the possibility of someone walking into school incapable of really functioning.
Right. And also you don't want to, and the thing I see almost more frequently than people not doing it is I see people trying to get a two-year-old to share. Well, two-year-olds developmentally aren't ready to do that. They're going to do parallel play. They'll play next to each other. But it's very difficult for them to do real sharing in the way we do it. Maybe we can begin to set some time limits and have them give the toy over. But they may very well not be able to let go of that toy very well because developmentally they don't have the skill. But by 3, they ought to begin to be able to do that. You would want them to be doing that. And you should be working with that.
Very good. Well, this book is absolutely terrific, and I'm not even a parent, but I just digested it with great, great interest, and I know that a lot of people, but particularly parents concerned about this, will find all kinds of things to value in the Emily Post, The Gift of Good Manners, A Parent's Guide to Raising Respectful, Kind, Considerate Children. It's published by Harper Resource, and one of the co-authors, Cindy Post Senning. Cindy Post Senning, a real pleasure to speak with you today on The Morning Show. Best wishes to you.
Well, thank you very much. My pleasure also.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we'll be talking about 3 different holiday-themed events that are going on this weekend, in addition to the Kenosha Symphony Concert, which we talked about today. We'll open up by talking about the current production of the Lakeside Players. That is A Charlie Brown Christmas, which opened last weekend. Performances are this weekend and the following weekend at the Rohde Center for the Arts in downtown Kenosha. You'll hear the conversation I recorded with the director of that production, Norgie Metzinger. We'll also be talking about the Music and More Candlelight concert that's happening Saturday night at First Presbyterian Church in downtown Racine. And then we'll also have some information for you about the concert that is coming up Sunday afternoon, being presented by the Spirit of Racine Music Makers, a free concert at the Covenant at Murray Mansion. All of that coming up on tomorrow's morning show. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, wgtd.com.